Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2001, edited by Barbara Kingsolver. The Secrets of Bats by Jess Rowe. Alice Leung has discovered the secrets of bats, how they see without seeing, how they own darkness as we own light. She walks the halls with a black headband across her eyes, keening a high C. Cheat, 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 cheat. Never once veering off course, as if drawn by an invisible thread. Echolocation, she tells me, it's not as difficult as you might think. Now she sees a light around objects when she looks at them, like halos on her retinas from staring at the sun. In her journal she writes, I had a dream that was all in blackness. Tell me how to describe. It is January, my fifth month in Hong Kong. In the margin I write, I wish I knew. After six, when the custodians leave, the school becomes a perfect acoustic chamber. She wanders from the basement laboratories to the basketball courts like a trapped bird looking for a window. She finds my door completely blind, she says, not counting flights or paces. Twisting her head from side to side like Stevie Wonder, she announces her progress. Another room mapped, a door, a desk, a globe, detected and identified by its aura. You'll hurt yourself, I tell her. I've had nightmares, her foot missing the edge of a step, the dry crack of a leg breaking. Try it without the blindfold, I say. That way you can check yourself. Her mouth wrinkles. This not important, she says. This only practice. Practice for what, I want to ask. All the more reason you have to be careful. You keep saying, she says, grabbing a piece of chalk. EXPERIMENT, she writes on the blackboard, digging it in until it squeals. That's right. Sometimes experiments fail. Sometimes, she repeats. She eyes me suspiciously as if I invented the word. Go home, I tell her. She turns her pager off and leaves it in her locker. Sometimes police appear at the school gate, shouting her name. Somebody, it seems, wants her back. In the doorway she whirls, flipping her hair out of her eyes. 10 days more, she says. You listen. Maybe then you see why. The name of the school is Po Sing Uk, a 5-story concrete block, cracked and eroded by dirty rain, shoulder to shoulder with the tenements and garment factories of Chung Sha Wan. No air conditioning and no heat. In September, I shouted to be heard over a giant fan, and now in January, I teach in a winter jacket. When it rains, mildew spiderwebs across the ceiling of my classroom. Schoolgirls in white jumpers crowd into the room 40 at a time, falling asleep over their textbooks, making furtive calls on mobile phones, scribbling notes to each other on pink Hello Kitty paper. If I call on one who hasn't raised her hand, she folds her arms across her chest and stares at the floor, and the room falls silent as if by a secret signal. There's nothing more terrifying, I found, than the echo of your own voice. Who are you? It answers. What are you doing here? I've come to see my life as a radiating circle of improbabilities that grow from each other, like ripples in water around a dropped stone. That I became a high school English teacher, that I work in another country, that I live in Hong Kong. That a city can be a mirage, hovering above the ground. Skyscrapers built on mountainsides, islands swallowed in fog for days. That a language can have no tenses or articles, with 7 different ways of saying the same syllable. That my best student stares at the blackboard only when I erase it. She stayed behind on the first day of class, a tall girl with a narrow face, pinched around the mouth, her cheeks pitted with acne scars. Like most of my 16-year-olds, she looked 12, in a baggy uniform that hung to her knees like a sack. The others streamed past her without looking up, as if she were a boulder in the current. She stared down at my desk with a fierce vacancy, as if looking itself was an act of will. How do you think about bats? Bats? She joined her hands at the wrist and fluttered them at me. People are afraid of them, I said. I think they're very interesting. Why, she said, why very interesting? Because they live in the dark, I said. We think of them as being blind, but they aren't blind. They have a way of seeing with sound waves, just like we see with light. Yes, she said, I know this. Her body swayed slightly in an imaginary breeze. Are you interested in bats? I am interested, she said. I want to know how. She made a face I'd already come to recognize. I know how to say it in Chinese. When one bat sees the other, the feeling. You mean how one bat recognizes another? Yes, recognize. That's a good idea, I said. You can keep a journal about what you find. Write something in it every day. She nodded vehemently as if she'd already thought of that. There are books on bat behavior that will tell you. Not in books. She covered her eyes with one hand and walked forward until her hip brushed against the side of my desk, then turned away at a right angle. Like this, she said. There is a sound, she said. I want to find the sound. 18 September. First hit tuning fork. Sing one octave higher. A, B, C. This is best way. Drink water or lips get dry. I must have eyes totally closed. No light. So some kind of black, like cloth, is good. Start singing, first to the closest wall. Sing and listen. Practice 10 times, 20 times. Important. Cannot move until I hear the wall. Take step back, 1 time, 2 time. Listen again. I have to hear difference first, then move. Then take turn, 90 degrees left. Then turn, 180 degrees left. Feel position with feet. Feet, very important. They are wings. I don't know what this is, I told her the next day, opening the journal and pushing it across the desk. Can you help me? I tell you already, she said. She hunched her shoulders so that her head seemed to rest on them, spreading her elbows to either side. It is like a test. A test? In the courtyard, rain crackled against the asphalt. A warm wind lifted scraps of paper from the desk, somersaulting them through the air. The sound, she said impatiently. I told you this. I covered my mouth to hide a smile. Alice, I said, humans can't do that. It isn't a learned behavior. It's something you study. She pushed up the cover of the composition book and let it fall. I think I can help you, I said. Can you tell me why you want to write this? Why I want? She stared at me wide-eyed. Why do you want to do this? What is the test for? Her eyes lifted from my face to the blackboard behind me, moved to the right, then the left, as if measuring the dimensions of the room. Why you want to come to Hong Kong? Many reasons, I said. After college, I wanted to go to another country, and there was a special fellowship available here, and maybe someday I will be a teacher. You are a teacher. I'm just learning, I said. I'm trying to be one. Then why you have to leave America? I don't, I said. The two things. I took off my glasses and rubbed my eyes. All at once I was exhausted. The effort seemed useless, a pointless evasion. When I looked up, she was nodding slowly as if I'd just said something profound. I think I will find the reason for being here only after some time, I said. Do you know what I mean? There could be a purpose I don't know about. So you don't know for good. Not sure. You could say that. Hi, Yat Young, she said. The same. Maybe if you read, you can tell me why. This is what's so strange about her, I thought, studying her red-rimmed eyes, the tiny veins standing out like wires on a circuit board. She doesn't look down. I'm fascinated by her, I thought. Is that fair? You're different from the others, I said. You're not afraid of me. Why is that? Maybe I have other things to be afraid of. At first, the fifth-floor bathroom was her echo chamber. She sat in one corner on a stool taken from the physics room and placed an object directly opposite her. A basketball, a glass, a feather. Sound waves triangulate, she told me. Corners are best. Passing by, at the end of the day, I stopped, closing my eyes, and listened for the difference. She sang without stopping for 5 minutes, hardly taking a breath. Almost a mechanical sound, as if someone had forgotten their mobile phone. Other teachers walked by in groups, talking loudly. If they noticed me or the sound, I was never aware of it, but always instinctively I looked at my watch and followed them down the stairs. As if I, too, had to rush home to cook for hungry children or boil medicine for my mother-in-law. I never stayed long enough to see if anything changed. Document everything, I told her, and she did. Now I have 2 binders of entries, 41 in all. Hallway, chair, notebook, as if we were scientists writing a grant proposal, as if there were something actual to show at the end of it. I don't keep a journal or take photographs, and my letters home are factual and sparse. No one in Larchmont would believe me, not even my parents, if I told them the truth. It sounds like quite an experience you're having. Don't get run over by a rickshaw. And yet if I died tomorrow, why should I ever think this way? These binders would be the record of my days. Those and Alice herself, who looks out of her window and with her eyes closed sees ships passing in the harbor, men walking silently in the streets. 26 January. Sound of light bulb, low like bees hum. So hard to listen. A week ago I dreamed of bodies breaking apart, arms and legs and torsos, fragments of bones, bits of tissue. I woke up flailing in the sheets and remembered her immediately. There was too long a moment before I believed I was awake. It has to stop, I thought. You have to say something, though I know I can't. Perhaps there was a time when I might have told her, "This is ridiculous," or, "You're 16, find some friends. What will people think?" But this is Hong Kong, of course, and I have no friends, no basis to judge. I leave the door open always, and no one ever comes to check. We walk out of the gates together late in the afternoon, past the watchman sleeping in his chair. For me, she has a kind of professional courtesy, ignoring my whiteness politely as if I had horns growing from my head. And she returns at the end of each day as a bat flies back to its cave at daybreak. All I have is time. Who am I to pack my briefcase and turn away? There was only once when I slipped up. "Pretend I've forgotten," I told her, one Monday in early October. The journal was open in front of us, the pages covered in red. She squinted down at it as if instead of corrections I'd written hieroglyphics. "I'm an English teacher," I thought. "This is what I'm here for. We should start again at the beginning," I said. "Tell me what it is that you want to do here. You don't have to tell me about the project, just about the writing. Whom are you writing these for? Whom do you want to read them?" She stretched, cat-like, curling her fingers like claws. "Because I don't think I understand," I said. "I think you might want to find another teacher to help you. There could be something you have in mind in Chinese that doesn't come across." "Not in Chinese," she said, as if I should have known that already. "In Chinese cannot say like this. But it isn't really English either." "I know this. It is like both." "I can't teach that way," I said. "You have to learn the rules before you can." "You are not teaching me." "Then what's the point?" She strode across the room to the window and leaned out, placing her hands on the sill and bending at the waist. "Come here," she said. "Look." I stood up and walked over to her. She ducked her head down like a gymnast on a bar and tilted forward, her feet lifting off the floor. "Alice!" I grabbed her shoulder and jerked her upright. She stumbled, falling back. I caught her wrist and she pulled it away, steadying herself. We stood there a moment, staring at each other, breathing in short huffs that echoed in the hallway. "Maybe I hear something and forget," she said. "You catch me then, okay?" 28 January. It is like photo negative. All the colors are the opposite. Black sky, white trees, this way. But they are still shapes. I can see them. I read, standing at the window, in the last sliver of sunlight. Alice stands at my desk, already well in shadow, turning around slowly as if trying to dizzy herself for a party game. Her winter uniform cardigan is three sizes too large, unopened. It falls behind her like a cape. "This is beautiful." "Quiet," she hisses, eyebrows bunched together above her headband. "One second." "There." "There." "What is it?" "A man on the stairs." I go out into the hallway and stand at the top of the stairwell, listening. Five floors below, very faintly, I hear sandals skidding on the concrete, keys jangling on the janitor's ring. "You heard him open the gate," I say. "That's cheating." She shakes her head. I hear heartbeat. The next Monday, Principal Ho comes to see me during the lunch hour. He stands at the opposite end of the classroom, as always. A tall, slightly chubby man in a tailored shirt, gold-rimmed glasses, and Italian shoes, who blinks as he reads the ESL posters I've tacked up on the wall. When he asks how my classes are and I tell him that the girls are unmotivated, disengaged, he nods quickly as if to save me the embarrassment. "How lucky he was," he tells me, "to go to boarding school in Australia," and then pronounces it with a flattened A, Australia, so I have to laugh. Principal Ho, I asked, do you know Alice Leung? He turns his head towards me and blinks more rapidly. Leung Ka Yi, he says. Of course, you have a problem with her? No, sir, I need something to hold. My hands dart across the desk behind me and find my red marking pen. How does she perform? She's very gifted, one of the best students in the class, very creative. He nods, scratches his nose, and turns away. She likes to work alone, I say. The other girls don't pay much attention to her. I don't think she has many friends. It is very difficult for her, he says slowly, measuring every word. Her mother was a suicide. In the courtyard, 5 stories down, someone drops a basketball and lets it bounce against the pavement, little pings that trill and fade into the infinite. In Yao Ma Te, Ho says. He makes a little gliding motion with his hand. Nowadays, this is not so uncommon in Hong Kong, but still there are superstitions. What kind of superstitions? He frowns and shakes his head. Difficult to say in English, maybe just that she is unlucky girl. Chinese people, you understand, some are still afraid of ghosts. She isn't a ghost. He gives a high-pitched, nervous laugh. No, no, he says, not her. He puts his hands into his pockets, searching for something. Difficult to explain, I'm sorry. Is there someone she can talk to? He raises his eyebrows. A counselor, I'm about to say, and explain what it means when my hand relaxes and I realize I've been crushing the pen in my palm. For a moment, I'm water skiing again at Lake Pachog, releasing the handle, settling against the surface, enfolded in water. When I look up, Ho glances at his watch. If you have any problem, you can talk to me. It's nothing, I say, just curious, that's all. She wears a headband all the time now, I've noticed, pulling it over her eyes whenever possible, in the halls between classes, in the courtyard at lunchtime, sitting by herself. No one shoves her or calls her names. She passes through the crowds unseen. If possible, I think she's grown thinner, her skin translucent, blue veins showing at the wrists. Occasionally I notice the other teachers shadowing her, frowning, their arms crossed, but if our eyes meet, they stare through me, disinterested, and look away. I have to talk to you about something. She is sitting in a desk at the far end of the room, reading her chemistry textbook, drinking from a can of soy milk with a straw. When the straw gurgles, she bangs the can down, and we sit silently, the sound reverberating in the hallway. I give you another journal soon, 2 more days. Not about that. She doesn't move, fixed, alert, waiting. I stand up and move down the aisle toward her, sitting 2 desks away, and as I move, her eyes grow slightly rounder, and her cheeks puff out slightly as if she's holding her breath. Alice, I say, can you tell me about your mother? Her hands fall down on the desk, and the can clatters to the floor, white drops spinning in the air. Mother? Who tell you I have mother? It's all right. I reach over to touch one hand, and she snatches it back. Who tell you? It doesn't matter. You don't have to be angry. You big mistake, she said, wild-eyed, taking long swallows of air and spitting them out. Why you have to come here and mess everything? I don't understand, I say. Alice, what did I do? I trust you, she says, and pushes the heel of one palm against her cheek. I write and you read. I trust you. What did you expect? I ask, my jaw trembling. Did you think I would never know? Believe me, she looks at me pleadingly. Believe me. 2 days later, she leaves her notebook on my desk with a note stuck to the top. You keep. 1 February. Now I am finished. It is out there. I hear it. I call out to her after class, and she hesitates in the doorway for a moment before turning, pushing her back against the wall. Tell me what it was like, I say. Was it a voice? Did you hear someone speaking? Of course no voice. Not so close to me. It was a feeling. How did it feel? She reaches up and slides a headband over her eyes. It is all finished, she says. You not worry about me any more. Too late, I say. I stand up from my chair and take a tentative step toward her, weak-kneed as if it were a staircase in the dark. You chose me, I say, remember? Go back to America, then you forget all about this crazy girl. This is my life, too. Did you forget about that? She raises her head and listens, and I know what she hears, A stranger's voice, as surely as if someone else had entered the room. She nods. Whom do you see, I wonder? What will he do next? I reach out blindly, and my hand misses the door. On the second try, I close it. I choose this, I say. I'm waiting. Tell me. Her body sinks into a crouch. She hugs her knees and tilts her head back. Warm. It was warm. It was. It was a body. But not close to you? Not close. Only little feeling, then no more. Did it know you were there? No. How can you be sure? When I look up to repeat the question, shiny tracks of tears have run out from under the blindfold. I am sorry, she says. She reaches into her backpack and splits open a pack of tissues without looking down, her fingers nimble, almost autonomous. You are my good friend, she says, and takes off the blindfold, turning her face to the side and dabbing her eyes. Thank you for helping me. It isn't over, I say. How can it be over? Like you say, sometimes experiment fails. No, I say too loudly, startling us both. It isn't that easy. You have to prove it to me. Prove it to you. Show me how it works. I take a deep breath. I believe you. Will you catch me? Her eyes widen and she does not look away. The world swims around her irises. Tonight, she says, and writes something on a slip of paper, not looking down. I see you then. In a week it will be the new year. All along the streets the shop fronts are hung with firecrackers, red and gold character scrolls, pictures of grinning cats, and the twin cherubs of good luck. Mothers lead little boys dressed in red silk pajamas, girls with New Year's pigtails. The old woman sitting next to me on the bus is busily stuffing $20 bills into red lycee packets, lucky money for the year to come. When I turn my head from the window, she holds one out to me and I take it with both hands, automatically bowing my head. This will make you rich, she says to me in Cantonese, and lots of children. Thank you, I say, the same to you. She laughs. Already happened. Jade bangles clink together as she holds up her fingers. 13 grandchildren, she says. 6 boys, all fat and good-looking. You should say live long life to me. I'm sorry, my Chinese is terrible. No, it's very good, she says. You were born in Hong Kong? Outside, night is just falling, and Nathan Road has become a canyon of light. Blazing neon signs, brilliant shop windows, decorations blinking across the fronts of half-finished tower blocks. I stare at myself a moment in the reflection, 3 red characters passing across my forehead, and look away. No, I say, in America. I've lived here only since August. Ah, then what is America like? Forgive me, Aunt, I say. I forget. Prosperous Garden Number 4, Tung Kung Street, Yao Mai Te. A scribble of Chinese characters. Show this to doorman. He let you in. The building is on the far edge of Kowloon, next to the reclamation. A low concrete barrier separates it from an elevated highway that thunders continuously as cars pass. 4 identical towers around a courtyard, long poles draped with laundry jutting from every window like spears hung with old rotted flags. Gong hei fat choi, I say to the doorman through the gate, and he smiles with crooked teeth. But when I pass the note to him, all expression leaves his face. He presses the buzzer and turns away quickly. 23, ah, he calls out to the opposite wall. You understand? Thank you. When I step out into the hallway, I breathe in boiled chicken, oyster sauce, frying oil, the acrid steam of medicine, dried fish, Dettol. 2 young boys are crouched at the far end, sending a radio-controlled car zipping past me. Someone is arguing loudly over the telephone. A stereo plays loud canto pop from a balcony somewhere below. All the apartment doors are open, I notice, walking by, and only the heavy sliding gates in front of them are closed. Like a honeycomb, I can't help thinking, or an ant farm. But when I reach 23A, the door behind the gate is shut, and no sound comes from behind it. The bell rings several times before the locks begin to snap open. You are early, Alice says, rubbing her eyes as if she's been sleeping. Behind her, the apartment is dark. There's only a faint blue glow as if from a TV screen. I'm sorry you didn't say when to come. I look at my watch, 8:30. I can come back, I say, another time, maybe another night. She shakes her head and opens the gate. When she turns on the light, I draw a deep breath involuntarily and hide it with a cough. The walls are covered with stacks of yellowed paper, file boxes, brown envelopes, and ragged books. On opposite sides of the room are two desks, each holding a computer with a flickering screen. I peer at the one closest to the door. At the top of the screen there's a rotating globe, and below it a ribbon of letters and numbers, always changing. The other, I see, is just the same, a head staring at its twin. "Come," Alice says. She has disappeared for a moment and re-emerged dressed in a long dress, silver running shoes, a hooded sweatshirt. "Are these yours?" "No, my father's." "Why does he need two? They're just the same." "Nicey," she said impatiently, pointing. "FTSE, New York Stock Exchange, London Stock Exchange." "Sow ye," a hoarse voice calls from another room. "Who is it?" "It's my English teacher," she says loudly, "giving me a homework assignment." "Gowala, ah?" "Yes," she says, "the white one." "Then call a taxi for him." He appears in the kitchen doorway, a stooped old man, perhaps 5 feet tall, in a dirty white T-shirt, shorts, and sandals. His face is covered with liver spots, his eyes shrunken into their sockets. "I sorry, ah," he says to me, "no speaky English." "It's all right," I say. There's a numbness growing behind my eyes. I want to speak to him, but the words are all jumbled and Alice's eyes burning on my neck. "Goodbye," I say. "Take care." "See later, ah." Alice pulls the hood over her head and opens the door. She leads me to the top of a dark stairwell in front of a rusting door with light pouring through its cracks. "Tin Pong," she says, reading the characters stenciled on it in white. "Roof." She hands me a black headband identical to her own. "Hold on," I say, gripping the railing with both hands. The numbness behind my eyes is still there, and I feel my knees growing weak, as if there are no building below me, only a framework of girders and air. "Can you answer me a question?" "Maybe one." "Has he always been like that?" "What like? With the computers," I say. "Does he do that all the time?" "Always. Never turn them off." In the darkness I can barely see her face, only the eyes shining, daring me to speak. "If I were in your place," I say to myself, and the phrase dissolves, weightless. "Listen," I say, "I'm not sure I'm ready." She laughs. "When you be sure." Her fingers fall across my face and I feel the elastic brushing over my hair, and then the world is black. I open my eyes and close them. No difference. "We just go for a little walk," she says. "You don't worry. Only listen." I never realized before the weight of the air. At every step I feel the great mass of it pressing against my face, saddled on my shoulders. I am breathing huge quantities as if my lungs were a giant recirculation machine, and sweat is running down from my forehead and soaking the edge of the headband. Alice takes normal-sized steps and grips my hand fiercely so I can't let go. "Don't be afraid," she shouts. "We are still in the middle, not near the edge." "What am I supposed to do?" "Nothing," she says, "only wait. Maybe you see something." I stare fiercely into blackness, into my own eyelids. There is the afterglow of the hallway light and the computer screens, very faint. Or am I imagining it? What is there on a roof, I wonder, and try to picture it. Television antennas, heating ducts, clotheslines. Are there guardrails? I've never seen any on a Hong Kong building. She turns and I brush something metal with my hand. "Do you know where you're going?" I shout. "Here," she says, and stops. I stumble into her and she catches my shoulder. "Careful," she says. "We wait here." "Wait for what?" "Just listen," she says. "I tell to you. Look to left side. There's a big building there. Very tall white building, higher than us. Small windows." "All right, I can see that." "Right side is highway. Very bright. Many cars and trucks passing." If I strain to listen, I can hear a steady whooshing sound and then the high whine of a motorcycle, like a mosquito passing my ear. "Okay," I say, "got that." In the middle is very dark, small buildings, only few lights on. "Not enough," I say. "One window close to us," she says, "two little children there. You see them?" "No." "Lift your arm," she says, and I do. "Put your hand up. See? They wave to you." "My God," I say, "how do you do that?" She squeezes my hand. "You promised me something." "Of course. What is it?" You don't take it off, she says. No matter, nothing. You promise me? I do, I promise. She lets go of my hand, and I hear running steps, soles skidding on concrete. Alice, I shout, rooted to the spot. I crouch down and balance myself with my hands. Alice, you don't. Mama, she screams 10 feet away, and the sound carries, echoes. I can see it slanting with the wind, bright as daylight, as if a Roman candle had exploded in my face. Mama, 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 she sings, and I'm crawling toward her on hands and knees, feeling in front of me for the edge. She is there, Alice shouts. You see? She is in the air. I see her. Stay where you are. You watch, she says. I follow her. She doesn't want you, I shout. She doesn't want you there. Let her go. There's a long silence, and I stay where I am, the damp concrete soaking through to my knees. My ears are ringing, and the numbness has blossomed through my head. I feel faintly seasick. Alice? You can stand up, she says in a small voice, and I do. You are shaking, she says. She puts her arms around me from behind and clasps my chest, pressing her head against my back. I thank you, she says. She unties the headband. 6 February. Man waves white hands at black sky. He says, aren't you happy be alive? Aren't you? He kneels and kisses floor. And that story was The Secret of Bats by Jess Rowe from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2001, edited by Barbara Kingsolver. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, Brothers and Sisters Around the World by Andrea Lee. I took them around the point toward Zanzibar, Michelle tells me. Those two little whores, just 10 minutes. They asked me for a ride when I was down on the beach bailing out the Zodiac. It was rough, and I went too fast on purpose. You should have seen their titties bounce. He tells me this in French, but with a carefree lewdness that could be Roman. He is, in fact, half Italian, product of the officially French no-man's land where the Ligurian Alps touched the massive Central. In love, like so many of his Mediterranean compatriots, with boats, with hot blue seas, with dusky women, with the steamy belt of tropics that girdles the earth. We live above Cannes, in Mougins, where it's always sunny, but on vacation we travel the world to get hotter and wilder. Islands are what Michelle prefers, in Asia, Oceania, Africa, and the Caribbean. It doesn't matter. Any place where the people are the color of different grades of coffee, and mangoes plop in mushy heaps on the ground, and the reef fish are brilliant as a box of new crayons. On vacation, Michelle sheds his manicured ad-man image, and with innocent glee sets about turning himself into a Eurotrash version of Tarzan. Bronzed muscles well in evidence, shark's tooth on a leather thong, fishing knife stuck into the waist of a threadbare peru, and a wispy, sun-streaked ponytail that he tends painstakingly along with the chin crop of Hollywood stubble. He loves me for a number of wrong reasons connected with his dreams of hot islands. It makes no difference to him that I grew up in Massachusetts, wearing L.L. Bean boots more often than sandals. After 8 years of marriage, he doesn't seem to see that what gives strength to the spine of an American black woman, however exotic she appears, is a steely Protestant core, a core that in its absolutism is curiously cold and Nordic. The fact is that I'm not crazy about the tropics, but Michelle doesn't want to acknowledge that. Mysteriously, we continue to get along. In fact, our marriage is surprisingly robust, though at the time of our wedding, my mother, my sister, and my girlfriends all gave it a year. I sometimes think the secret is that we don't know each other and never will. Both of us are lazy by nature, and that makes it convenient to hang on to the fantasies we conjured up back when we met in Milan. Mine of the French gentleman adventurer, and his of a pliant black goddess whose feelings accord with his. It's no surprise to me when Michelle tries to share the ribald thoughts that run through the labyrinth of his Roman Catholic mind. He doubtless thought that I would get a kick out of hearing about his boat ride with a pair of African sluts. Those girls have been sitting around watching us from under the mango tree since the day we rolled up from the airport to spend August in the house we borrowed from our friend Jean-Claude. Michelle was driving Jean-Claude's car, a Citroën so rump-sprung from the unpaved roads that it moves like a tractor. Our 4-year-old son, Lele, can drag his sneakers in red dust through the holes in the floor. The car smells of failure, like the house, which is built on an island off the northern coast of Madagascar, on a beach where a wide scalloped bay spreads like 2 blue wings, melting into the sky and the wild archipelago of Lemur Islands beyond. Behind the garden stretch fields of sugar cane and groves of silvery, arthritic-looking ylang-ylang trees, whose flowers lend a tang of Africa to French perfume. The house is low and long around a grandiose veranda, and was once whitewashed into an emblem of colonial vainglory. Now the walls are the indeterminate color of damp, and the thinning palm thatch on the roof swarms with mice and geckos. It has a queenly housekeeper named Hadija, whose perfect pommes frites and plates of crudités, like the dead bidet and dried-up tubes of bain de soleil in the bathroom, are monuments to Jean-Claude's ex-wife, who went back to Toulon after seeing a series of projects, a frozen fish plant, a perfume company, a small luxury hotel, swallowed up in the calm fireworks of the sunsets. Madagascar is a perfect place for a white fool to lose his money, Michelle says. He and I enjoy the scent of dissolution in our borrowed house, fuck inventively in the big mildewed ironwood bed, sit in happiness in the sad bottom-out canvas chairs on the veranda after a day of spearfishing, watching our son race in and out of herds of humpback zebu cattle on the beach. The only problem for me has been those girls. They're not really whores, just local girls who dance at Bar Caribou on Thursday nights and hang around the few French and Italian tourists hoping to trade sex for a T-shirt, a hair clip. They don't know to want Ray-Bans yet. This is not the Caribbean. I'm used to the women from the Comoros Islands who crowd onto the beach near the house, dressed up in gold bangles and earrings and their best lace-trimmed blouses. They clap and sing in circles for hours, jumping up to dance in pairs, wagging their backsides in tiny precise jerks, laughing and flashing gold teeth. They wrap themselves up in their good time in a way that intimidates me, and I've come to an understanding with the older women of the village, who come by to bring us our morning ration of zebu milk, we drink it boiled in coffee, or to barter with Rideau Richelieu, the beautiful muslin cutwork curtains that they embroider. They are intensely curious about me, l'Américaine, who looks not unlike one of them, but who dresses and speaks and acts like a foreign madam, and is clearly married to the white man, not just a casual concubine. They ask me for medicine, and if I weren't careful, they would clean out my supply of Advil and Bimaxin. They go crazy over Lele, whom they call Bébé Métis, the mixed baby. I want to know all about them, their still eyes, their faces of varying colors that show both African and Indonesian blood, as I want to know everything about this primeval chunk of Africa floating in the Indian Ocean, with its bottle-shaped baobabs and strange tinkling music, the sega, which is said to carry traces of tunes from Irish sailors. But the girls squatting under the mango tree stare hard at me whenever I sit out on the beach or walk down to the water to swim. Then they make loud comments in Malagasy and burst out laughing. It's juvenile behavior, and I can't help sinking right down to their level and getting provoked. They're probably about 18 years old, both good-looking. One with a flat brown face and the long, straight, shining hair that makes some Madagascar women resemble Polynesians. The other darker, with the tiny features that belong to the coastal people called Marina and a pile of kinky hair tinted reddish. Both are big-titted, as Michelle pointed out, the merchandise spilling out of a pair of Nouvelle Frontière T-shirts that they must have gotten from a tour group leader. Some days they have designs painted on their faces in yellow sulfur clay. They stare at me and guffaw and stretch and give their breasts a competitive shake. Sometimes they hoot softly or whistle when I appear. My policy has been to ignore them, but today they've taken a step ahead, gotten a rise, however ironic, out of my man. It's a little triumph. I didn't see the Zodiac ride, but through the bathroom window I saw them coming back. I was shaving my legs. Waxing never lasts long enough in the tropics. Squealing and laughing, they floundered out of the rubber dinghy, patting their hair, settling their T-shirts, retying the cloth around their waists. One of them blew her nose through her fingers into the shallow water. The other said something to Michelle, and he laughed and patted her on the backside. Then, arrogantly, as two Cleopatras, they strode across the hot sand and took up their crouch under the mango tree, a pair of brown netsuke, waiting for my move. So, finally, I act. Michel comes sauntering inside to tell me, and after he tells me, I make a scene. He's completely taken aback. He's gotten spoiled since we've been married, used to my American cool, which can be seen even cooler than French nonchalance. He thought I was going to react the way I used to when I was still modeling, and he used to flirt with some of the girls I was working with, some of the bimbos who weren't serious about their careers. That is, that I was going to chuckle, display complicity, even excitement. Instead, I yell, say he's damaged my prestige among the locals, say that things are different here. The words seem to be flowing up into my mouth from the ground beneath my feet. He's so surprised that he just stands there with his blue eyes round and his mouth a small O in the midst of that Indiana Jones stubble. Then I hitch up my soleado bikini and march outside to the mango tree. Va-ten, I hiss to Red Hair, who seems to be top girl of the duo. Go away. Ne parle plus avec mon homme. The two of them scramble to their feet, but they don't seem to be going anywhere, so I slap the one with the straight hair. Except for once, when I was about 10, in a fight with my cousin Brenda, I don't believe I've ever seriously slapped anyone. This, on the scale of slaps, is half-assed, not hard. In that second of contact, I feel the strange smoothness of her cheek and an instantaneous awareness that my hand is just as smooth. An electric current seems to connect them. A red light flickers in the depths of the girl's dark eyes, like a computer blinking on, and then, without saying anything to me, both girls scuttle off down the beach, talking loudly to each other and occasionally looking back at me. I make motions as if I'm shooing chickens. Allez-vous-en! I screech. Far off down the beach, they disappear into the palms. Then I go and stretch out in the water, which is like stretching out in blue air. I take off my bikini top and let the equatorial sun print my shadow on the white sand below, where small white fish graze. I feel suddenly calm, but at the same time my mind is working very fast. My dear, who invited you to come halfway across the world and slap somebody? I ask myself in the ultra-reasonable tones of my mother, the school guidance counselor. Suddenly I remember another summer on yet another island. This was in Indonesia a few years ago, when we were exploring the back roads of one of the Moluccas. The driver was a local kid who didn't speak any language we spoke and was clearly gay. A great-looking kid with light brown skin pitted with a few acne scars and neat dreadlocks that would have looked stylish in Manhattan. A Princess Di t-shirt and peeling red nail polish. When we stopped at a waterfall and Michelle the adventurer went off to climb the lava cliffs, I sat down on a flat rock with the driver, whipped out my beauty case, and painted his nails shocking pink. He jumped when I first grabbed his hand, but when he saw what I was up to, he gave me a huge, ecstatic grin and then closed his eyes. And there it was, paradise. The waterfall, the jungle, and that beautiful kid with his long fingers lying in my hand. It was Michelle who made a fuss that time, jealous of something he couldn't even define. But I had the same feeling I do now, of acting on instinct and on target, the right act, at the right moment. "Mama, what did you do?" Lele comes running up to me from where he'd been squatting naked on the beach, playing with two small boys from the village. His legs and backside and little penis are covered with sand. I see the boys staring after him, one holding a toy they've been squabbling over, a rough wooden model of a truck without wheels tied with a piece of string to a stick. "Ismail says you hit a lady." Word has already spread along the beach, which is like a stage where a different variety show goes on every hour of the day. The said acts are the tides, which determine the movements of fishing boats, pirogues, zodiacs, and sailboats. There is always action on the sand. Women walk up and down with bundles on their heads. Bands of ragged children dig clams at low tide or launch themselves into the waves at high tide to surf with a piece of old timber. Yellow dogs chase chickens and fight over shrimp shells. Palm branches crash down on corrugated iron roofs. Girls with lacy dresses and bare sandy shanks parade to mass. The little mosque opens and shuts its creaky doors. Boys play soccer, kicking a plastic water bottle. Babies howl. Sunburned tourist couples argue and reconcile. Gossip flashes up and down with electronic swiftness. I sit up in the water and grab Lele and kiss him all over while he splashes and struggles to get away. "Yes, that's right," I tell him. It's the firm, didactic voice I use when we've turned off the Teletubbies videos and I'm playing the ideal parent. "I did hit a lady," I say. "She needed hitting. I, the mother who instructs her cross-cultural child in tolerance and nonviolence. Lele has a picture book called Brothers and Sisters Around the World, full of illustrations of cookie-cutter figures of various colors holding hands across continents. All people belong to one family, it teaches. All oceans are the same ocean." Michelle, who has watched the whole scene, comes and tells me that in all his past visits to the island, he's never seen anything like it. He's worried. The women fight among themselves or they fight with their men for sleeping with the tourists, he says. But no foreign woman has ever got mixed up with them. He talks like an anthropologist about loss of face and vendetta. "We might get run out of here," he says nervously. I tell him to relax, that absolutely nothing will happen. Where do I get this knowledge? It is sifted into me from the water, the air. So, as we planned, we go off spearfishing over by Nosy Comba, where the coral grows in big pastel poofs like furniture in a Hollywood bedroom of the 50s. We find a den of rock lobster and shoot to, and take them back to Jean-Claude's house for Hadija to cook. Waiting for the lobster, we eat about 50 small oysters the size of mussels and shine flashlights over the beach in front of the veranda, which is crawling with crabs. Inside, Lele is snoring adenoidally under a mosquito net. The black sky above is alive with falling stars. Michelle keeps looking at me and shaking his head. Hadija comes out bearing the lobster magnificently broiled with vanilla sauce. To say she has presence is an understatement. She got married when she was 13 and is now, after 8 children, an important personage, the matriarch of a vast and prosperous island clan. She and I have gotten along fine ever since she realized that I wasn't going to horn in on her despotic rule over Jean-Claude's house or say anything about the percentage she skims off the marketing money. She has a closely braided head and is as short and solid as a boulder, on the spectrum of Madagascar skin colors well toward the darkest. This evening she's showing off her wealth by wearing over her peru a venerable Guns N' Roses t-shirt. She puts down the lobster, sets her hands on her hips, and looks at me, and my heart suddenly skips a beat. Hers, I realize, is the only opinion I care about. "Oh, madame," she says, flashing me a wide smile and shaking her finger indulgently, as if I'm a child who has been up to mischief. I begin breathing again. "Oh, madame." "Madame has a quick temper," Michelle says in a placating voice, and Hadija throws her head back and laughs till the Guns N' Roses logo shimmies. "She is right," she exclaims. "She's a good wife." Next morning, our neighbor Pierluigi pulls up to the house in his dust-covered Renault pickup. Pierluigi is Italian and back in Italy has a title and a castle. Here he lives in a bamboo hut when he's not away leading a shark-hunting safari to one of the wild islands a day's sail to the north. He is the real version of what Michelle pretends to be, a walking, talking character from a boy's adventure tale, with a corrugated scar low down on one side where a hammerhead once snatched a mouthful. The islanders respect him and bring their children to him for a worm cure he's devised from crushed papaya seeds. He can bargain down the tough Indian merchants in the market, and he sleeps with pretty tourists and island girls impartially. Nobody knows how many kids he has fathered on the island. "I hear your wife is mixing in local politics," he calls from the truck to Michelle, while looking me over with those shameless eyes that have gotten so many women in trouble. Pierluigi is 60 years old and has streaks of white in his hair, but he is still 6'4" and the best-looking man I've ever seen in my life. "Brava," he says to me. "Good for you, my dear. The local young ladies very often need things put in perspective, but very few of our lovely visitors know how to do it on their own terms." After he drives off, Michelle looks at me with new respect. "I can't say you don't have guts," he says later. Then, "You really must be in love with me." In the afternoon, after our siesta, when I emerge onto the veranda from Jean-Claude's shuttered bedroom, massaging phytoplage into my hair, smelling on my skin the pleasant odor of sex, I see, as I somehow expected, that the two girls are back under the mango tree. I walk out onto the burning sand, squinting against the glare that makes every distant object a flat black silhouette, and approach them for the second time. I don't think that we're in for another round, yet I feel my knees take on a wary pugilistic springiness. But as I get close to straight her, girl says, "Bonjour, madame." The formal greeting conveys an odd intimacy. It is clear that we are breathing the same air now, that we have taken each other's measure. Both girls look straight at me, no longer bridling. All three of us know perfectly well that the man, my European husband, was just an excuse, a playing field for our curiosity. The curiosity of sisters separated before birth and flung by the caprice of history half a world away from each other. Now in this troublesome way our connection has been established, and between my guilt and my dawning affection I suspect that I'll never get rid of these two. Already in my mind is forming an exasperating vision of the gifts I know I'll have to give them. Lace underpants, Tampax, music cassettes, body lotion, all of them extracted from me with the tender ruthlessness of family members anywhere. And then what? What, after all these years, will there be to say? Well, the first thing to do is answer. "Bonjour, mesdemoiselles," I reply in my politest voice. And because I can't think of anything else, I smile and nod at them and walk into the water, which, as always in the tropics, is as warm as blood. The whole time I swim, the girls are silent, and they don't take their eyes off of me. And that story was Brothers and Sisters Around the World by Andrea Lee from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2001, edited by Barbara Kingsolver. The next story is from Sudden Fiction International, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The Shoebreaker by Danielle Boulanger. "Where is Ponceloup?"
"I don't know, sir," replied the clerk.
"Baron," the owner said as he turned to speak to the client who'd just come in. "My staff and I saw him leave early this morning on your behalf."
"What I see," retorted the other, "is that I was counting on my shoes being ready at 4 o'clock. You assured me they would be. It is now 6 o'clock and the dinner is at 8. I don't intend to stand here cooling my heels."
"But, sir..."
"Don't tell me you're sorry. It is I, my dear man, who am sorry. You can't depend on anyone nowadays."
The baron looked down at his feet and wiggled his toes under the worn calfskin. He'd have to go to the dinner party in his old shoes, bulging from his bunions and bubbled by his corns. Obviously he was comfortable in them, but aren't we always anxious to try out our latest purchase? The pair of dress shoes that he had bought the day before that had tortured him so when he first put them on were still walking the streets of Paris, being broken in by a fellow named Ponceloup.
"May I make a suggestion?" ventured the owner. "I know the man well. I have used him for more than 30 years, sir. He has broken in over 12,000 pairs of shoes for me, following the customer's directives. He figures a morning per pair for normal feet, but an entire afternoon should be there by any deformity. Our exceptional patrons..." The baron didn't readily count himself among the latter. "I mean those whom it was nature's whim to deform, and God knows I pity them, will sometimes cost Ponceloup an entire day." With the tip of his cane, the baron maliciously applied pressure to the corn crowning the big toe of his right foot, swollen by gout. "Ponceloup is, moreover, a great judge of physiognomy, and I shall miss him. He knows at a glance whether to walk pigeon-toed or duck-footed, or to stuff a wad of cotton in the shoe at just the right place, that is to say, at the place that..."
"Baron? Sir?"
"Yes?"
"People like Ponceloup will be hard to come by in the future. Love for one's work is a thing of the past. Love for art is disappearing. But please sit down. He should be here any time now."
"Art!" cried out the baron. "Indeed, I shall sit down."
"Ponceloup," the owner continued, "belonged to my father before I took over the business." This sort of talk the baron savored, and time wore on. The salesmen, meanwhile, were coming and going, carrying piles of boxes, kneeling, wielding their shoehorns, here lacing up an Oxford, there vaunting the quality of the alligator, and over in the women's section assuming feminine poses as they side-saddled their fitting stools, clamping their knees together like women in bathing suits, not hesitating to look away should gaping thighs offer them the forbidden view. The owner kept a watchful eye on his people without diverting his attention from the baron, who, though not a particularly good customer, was a man of great renown. The Petit Chablis clan, lest one forget, still owned half of the country's railroads, and that is indeed what drew a good part of the clientele.
"Honestly, I can't understand what's keeping him."
"And it's getting dark," the baron sighed. They were about to give up when the door opened and Ponceloup appeared, green around the gills and dragging at the heels.
Ah, there you are. The Baron looked at his dress shoes, now gracing the shoebreaker's feet. They no longer bore a resemblance to the ones the Baron had purchased, but rather to the good old pair he now wore. His eyes wandered from the one to the other. "My dear fellow," he exclaimed, putting his hand on Pensloop's shoulder, "did everything go well?" "Everything, Baron, sir. There might still be a hint of stiffness in the reinforcement of the outer left heel. I apologize for that." "Am I getting old?" Pensloop wondered. "Is the leather less supple due to the newfangled methods of tanning and splicing, or might the stitching or the lining be too heavy?" "Unshoe him," the owner told a clerk. "I'd appreciate it," Pensloop uttered feebly. "Are you otherwise satisfied?" Baron Petit Chablis inquired. With the tip of his cane he pointed to the already bloated shoes, now emptied of Pensloop's feet, as well as of the scraps of cardboard, cotton balls, strips of cork, rubber discs, and the like. "They put in 18 kilometers," Pensloop declared. "I'd advise you to put them on right away while they're still warm. We'll obtain a more generous contact. Talcum powder." "The talc!" shouted the owner. "The talcum powder will save the day," mused Pensloop. The Baron had himself shod, laced up, and helped to his feet. He shook hands with the owner. At the same time he extended his left hand, which held his cane, trying discreetly to offer Pensloop a coin. He nearly blinded the poor devil in the process. The breaker watched the Baron as he left with short and hesitant steps. Seeing him stop in the middle of the street for relief, Pensloop felt the pain and even a twinge of shame. "Monsieur," he said to the owner, "I just can't do it any more." "What's that?" "I've lost my touch. Look." They could see the Baron limping off. "I did what I could," Pensloop muttered as he examined his lacerated feet. His socks were embedded in his flesh and darkened in spots with blood stains. "Come on now, don't give up, for heaven's sakes. You're the best breaker in all of Paris, Pensloop. The main thing in life is to be tops at something, remember?" "And tomorrow," interrupted Pensloop, his sense of honor reviving, "you'll do 2 pairs for me. There'll be a snap." "But I didn't see them on the customer's feet." The owner went to his file and pulled 2 sheets of vellum. "Here, he knows that Pensloop can't read, and Pensloop knows that he knows. If the boss is being mean again, it's because he esteems him, needs him, and can boast that no one else in all of Paris can break in shoes as well as Pensloop." "See you tomorrow," Pensloop murmured. Since his feet hurt him so, he put on his espadrilles, which he saved for the bad evenings. The boss, despite the fact that it was closing time, asked him to leave through the back service door. And that story was The Shoebreaker by Danielle Boulanger from Sutton Fiction International, edited by Robert Chapard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.